Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Coming up on the show, Governor Mark Gordon joins us for a wide-ranging discussion on a number of topics, including taxes.
I am committed to actually moving that conversation beyond, we just escaped it another year. You know, that kicking the can down the road that we've done the last 4 years, I don't think does a great service to the people of Wyoming.
Wyoming's First Lady, Jenny Gordon, is taking on hunger in Wyoming, and she's working with local organizations to make sure kids have enough to eat.
What I hope to do is really just make people aware of all of the organizations in their community that are doing the good work.
It used to be that ski resorts were able to reach full staff by just offering employees to be a season pass, but those days are long gone.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. More than 70,000 Wyomingites face problems with food insecurity, and it's a problem many communities are trying to tackle. Now, Wyoming's First Lady, Jenny Gordon, has announced her new Wyoming Hunger Initiative that's focused on addressing this issue. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler visited the food charity that got Gordon interested.
Wednesday mornings at the food group in Sheridan are usually busy. Volunteers are separating mountains of food into small piles on tables and rolling carts. More volunteers will pack the food group's weekend food bags, the cornerstone of the organization's work. Carrie McMeans is the food group's executive director.
You might see something such as a bag of pasta, a can of spaghetti meat sauce, some sort of canned vegetables, a bread, could be a tortilla or loaf bread, a breakfast item, granola bars or a cereal box, and two pieces of fresh fruit.
Those food bags are delivered to schools, and students take them home on Fridays. They are meant to help them get through the weekend with breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. That way, kids come back to school on Monday focused. McMean says hunger affects students' ability to learn, a part of something called toxic stress.
When a child comes to school and they're thinking about their next meal or that they didn't have breakfast, the world stops for them. And that's what we say is that barrier. We can't reach them in the way that we need to help them grow until we feed them.
Sheridan's food group started in 2010 after community members heard stories about local school children not having enough food at home. Aaron Waddell, chair of the food group's board, says they met at a local coffee shop and decided they were going to do something about it.
We started with only 40 kids, all at Coffeen Elementary, which is our neediest school in this district, and that's where it began. We didn't have any money. We were using the food bank of the Rockies. We got the same foods all the time from them. It was whatever they had.
Over time, the food group became its own nonprofit. It got more donations, expanded throughout the county, and created new programs. The group decided to invest in purchasing their own high-quality food for the kids. McMean says they are serving more than ever before.
Our metrics are difficult because we are anonymous. The need right now we serve for weekend food bags is about 420 children per week during the school year.
McMean says there are teen pantries for middle school and high school students, and they've retrofitted newspaper boxes that the food group has placed throughout the county. Those are filled with food and hygiene products that are available anytime.
So totally, you know, we're serving at least 500 plus children in Sheridan County per week.
Waddell says initially the biggest challenge was getting people to realize that this is a big issue locally. According to the Wyoming Department of Education, around 31% of students in Sheridan County schools qualify for free and reduced lunch.
In the beginning, we had a huge amount of resistance. People would say, no way do we have that kind of poverty here. And this is a bootstrap state, so go ahead and just pull up your bootstraps. Poverty is super complicated. It's not just about pulling up your bootstraps.
First Lady Jenny Gordon first heard about Sheridan's food insecurity issues after running into Waddell at the grocery store as she was buying food for the weekend bags. She thought a lot about the issue, and this October, Gordon announced the Wyoming Hunger Initiative. It's an issue she's been studying across the state, getting to know charities and groups that are fighting food insecurity in their communities. But for her, this initiative isn't about starting something new.
What I hope to do is really just make people aware of all of the organizations in their communities that are doing the good work. So rather than reinventing the wheel, I would just really like to spotlight those organizations, make people aware of what's going on.
According to No Kid Hungry, 1 in 6 children in Wyoming struggles with hunger. Gordon says her microphone as the state's first lady lends to the mission to stop childhood hunger in Wyoming. Her position also allows Gordon to raise money through the Governor's Residence Foundation that supports her initiative.
So we're going to, with the board, the foundation board that we've assembled, we're going to work on trying to make a grant process so that organizations who either want to start something or want to maybe build up or make their programs bigger can receive grants that will be associated with fixing this food insecurity that we have in our state.
Gordon says while the initiative is still getting started, she's focused on educating the public on the issue and making information about resources easily accessible for those who need it and for those interested in helping. And recently, Gordon's initiative and the Wyoming Department of Education received a $50,000 grant from No Kid Hungry to work on instituting a school breakfast program in classrooms throughout the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
Have a good day.
For the last couple of weeks, world leaders have been convening in Madrid, Spain for the United Nations Summit on Climate Change. Among them was a delegation of indigenous youth. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards caught up with one of the delegation who is there, representing the Wind River Reservation. Micah Lott begins with an introduction in Arapaho.
Haba dos hesispaye na asit na hinan enina hate nicha. Hello, my name is Micah Lott. My Arapaho name is hesispaye. My friends and allies call me Big Wind, and I am Arapaho from the Wind River Reservation. For me, a lot of my teachings have come from the people before me. My grandparents, my great-grandparents have really instilled a lot of values about taking care of the land and us being a part of the land. And then around 3 years ago, I ended up venturing out to Standing Rock and staying there for several months. And ever since then, I've just kind of dedicated my life to trying to figure out how I can play my part in fighting against climate change.
You know, it seems like Standing Rock really was a pivotal moment in sort of the indigenous environmental movement. Would you agree with that? Does it seem like that galvanized a generation of indigenous youth to kind of move forward and take risks and really make sure that your voices are heard?
Yeah, I feel like as an indigenous youth, I feel like we often feel like we're silenced and we're muted, even within our own communities. And it's hard because I'm an enrolled member of the Northern Arapaho tribe and did not understand until I was older, the whole concept that we were considered an oil and gas tribe. And I grew up at a housing project called Beaver Creek. And right across the street, we used to swim and fish in the Beaver Creek. And then in my 20s, finding out that right behind our housing project was one of the tribe's oil fields, and that actually industrial runoff was going through seasonal drainages that were being dumped into the Beaver Creek, which was then being dumped into the Little Wind, which then goes into the Big Wind, which then goes into the Bighorn. It made me really think about like the interconnectedness. I do agree that Standing Rock was a very pivotal point in history. But I don't feel like it's a new concept. Indigenous people have been fighting for our environment. We've been fighting for the land since time immemorial.
Is this the kind of message that you are trying to deliver at the UN Summit on Climate? And what else are you making sure that you are imparting while you're there?
Yeah, essentially, I feel like right now, at this current time in the climate crisis, I feel like we need all hands on deck. Me and my sibling Little Wind and a couple other local Indigenous youth planned the first climate summit in Wyoming on the Wind River Reservation in April. And what we did was we were trying to create a climate action plan for the reservation. And I feel like we came to a lot of consensus about what we're trying to do and what we're trying to save. I feel like it's really important to acknowledge that there are medicines and species, our relatives, who are under attack, and they're very vulnerable to climate change. Right now, what we can see is like within the next 100 years, Wyoming's temperatures are going to look more like Texas. And so that's going to change our entire terrain. And within the next 50 years, our glaciers are going to be gone. And that scares me because that's what replenishes all of our rivers. And I think traditional ecological knowledge is often forgotten and often isn't taken as seriously as Western climate science. What I want to do and what this delegation wants to do is to be able to amplify those voices, our voices, so that we can have collaborative solutions, so that we can have blended knowledge, and that we can come with a plan that is not only sustainable, but just for all people.
So I wonder if you can tell me what it is that you're doing at this climate change summit. You know, how are you spending your days? What is it that you're being asked to do as a delegation?
Our delegation comes from all different parts. We have representatives from Pacifica, the Arctic, and all over Turtle Island. And so I've been asked to sit on panels, speak on forums, and share my stories. There's also corporations here, and they do have voting power. And so they're using this power to try to find a way out of this without actually finding solutions. There's a lot of false solutions on the table that I feel like have been brought by corporations. And I want to come up with real solutions. For an example, one of them is this idea of carbon markets, essentially selling and buying carbon. Now, the problem with this is that a corporation can continue to pollute a river and continue to pollute the air in one area and then say that they're buying shares or that they're offsetting their carbon. A lot of the times, this comes at the expense of Indigenous people, because at the end of the day, Indigenous people, we make up less than 4% of the world's population, yet we're protecting 80% of the world's biodiversity, which tells me that we are not a vulnerable people. We're targeted continuously, and we're continuously targeted. And so that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm standing up, and that's why I feel like, you know, our voice as Indigenous people, as Indigenous youth, are important.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Indigenous youth climate activist Micah Big Wind Lott. Lott addressed over 500,000 people on a stage with the renowned activist Greta Thunberg, and when the delegation protested at the U.S. Embassy, was among 75 activists arrested by Spanish police.
Coming up, look at how unpredictable it can be to find seasonal ski workers. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Most ski resorts across the region have opened for the season, and record amounts of snow had some resorts opening early this year. But resorts don't just rely on snow. Seasonal workers are also vital And as Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, they're becoming as unpredictable as the weather.
I'm standing at the base of Christie Peak Express Lift at the Steamboat Springs Ski Resort in northern Colorado. In October alone, this resort saw a record 63 inches of fresh powder. The resort's Lauren Duke says it was an easy decision to open on November 15th.
Which was our historic earliest opening ever.
She says the turnout so far has been great. But an early opening doesn't come without its challenges.
We opened before we were really expecting most of our staff to be on board. And the interesting thing is that we're trying to train our staff as we're also open.
Like how to operate chairlift machinery as a liftie, or for instructors, the best way to teach a brand new skier how to get down the hill. Duke says currently they're at about 90% staffing, which she says is comfortable, but that level was the result of a concerted effort. Right now, the unemployment rate is around 4%. That makes for a very tight labor market. So to attract seasonal workers, ski resorts across the country are having to do more than just offer free skiing.
In order to attract the seasonal employee, they realize it's more than a ski pass.
That's Deb Holloway. This will be her 26th season on ski patrol at Steamboat. But don't call her a ski bum.
I'd say a ski enthusiast. I'm no longer in the bum classification. My husband and I have worked very hard for 45 years, and I don't think people would consider us bums.
Holloway has been doing this work long enough to see the industry evolve, and along with it, the surrounding community.
The amount of reasonable rental properties, I think, is certainly diminishing over time, and that's tough.
Holloway says that's partly because of the amount of second homes and the rise of services like Airbnb and VRBO taking potential homes out of the rental market. And it's the kind of thing that makes hiring workers that much more difficult. So Steamboat is part of a trend of resorts to offer workforce housing. The cheapest rates here go for about $300 a month. Plus, the units are right next to the resort. Norman Nickerson says that kind of proximity is important.
You're not going to drive from Denver all the way to Vail every single day as a worker.
Nickerson is the director of the Institute for Tourism and Recreation Research at the University of Montana.
And I know that some of the ski resorts have said, well, if we don't get full staff, we're right on that edge, and then of course somebody gets sick or they can't be there for a few days. The administrative people are out there doing those jobs just to fill in.
And when that doesn't work, she says resorts cut down on services, like reducing restaurant hours and closing particular runs.
You're leaving money on the table. They don't want to do that, but they're forced to.
And Nickerson points to another wrinkle in the industry's labor market. Resorts have traditionally depended on J-1 visa workers from other countries. But because the Trump administration has placed restrictions on that program under the Buy American, Hire American executive order, that pool of employees has also been reduced. David Byrd is with the National Ski Areas Association.
What I hear a lot from ski area owners and operators is that, and it's true from large resorts down to small resorts, we're not filling close to all the jobs that we have that are available.
With such a low unemployment rate across the country, Byrd says if you're looking for a job, the picking is yours. So ski resorts have no choice but to sweeten the deal. At Steamboat, that means workers get hot lunch or dinner for $3 to $5 and discounted equipment. Plus, there's a referral bonus. If a friend of an employee gets hired, that's $200 in their pocket. Steamboat's Lauren Duke says these tactics seem to be working, but
we still need lifties, we still need food and beverage attendants and ski school instructors.
And remember, if you're interested and land one of those jobs, you'll still get that season pass. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The Mountain West is a mecca for nature photographers, but they're facing some new competitors these days. Us. Anyone with a smartphone now has a fancy camera in their pocket, and if they're lucky, can stumble on a shot that a professional photographer has been waiting on for days. A grizzly, the elusive black-footed ferret, a perfect sunrise. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
I'm walking along a trail north of Boise, Idaho, near dusk with photographer Glenn Oakley.
Oh, look at there.
Oakley points to something flying a bit in the distance.
See that owl? It's an owl.
We're out in these somewhat rocky open hills, so he can show me what he looks for to photograph.
That's actually sort of the key spot down there, those outcrops. So we should go down there before the light completely vanishes.
Oakley's been a freelance nature photographer for decades, working with publications like Smithsonian Magazine, Life, and the New York Times. He's loved getting out and seeing beautiful landscapes.
And it kept me out of a cubicle. Very important.
He's 64 now and says things have changed since he started in college, from film to digital, from well-paying magazines to low-paying online websites, and to dealing with the new kid on the block, the smartphone. Those changes are steadily eating into freelancers' incomes.
$1,500 a day would be kind of a, you know, plus expenses. That was, you know, kind of normal. I think it's a lot harder to get now.
He's now up against people who may get a decent photo with their phone and then give it away for free on sites like Flickr or post it on an increasing number of apps to sell to customers or brands, apps like Fope or Snapwire. Oakley has largely moved on to video because that's where the work is. He says digital technology has opened up the world of photography to more people, and that's a good thing, but he sees smartphone hobby photographers in the wilderness as a negative trend.
And especially if the photograph doesn't really add anything to the world, you know, because it's been, you know, it's been shot a million times, maybe just put the camera down and take a breath and, you know, see what it looks like with your eyes.
I will either turn on Do Not Disturb on my phone or turn it off and just shoot everything with my DSLR and not worry about the phone.
That's Annie Koch in Missoula, Montana. She has about 5 years under her belt as a professional photographer. She agrees that phones and social media can be distracting and stressful, but she relies on them too.
Everything is on Instagram, and if you're a photographer, that's the best way to get recognized and to be seen is to have a really cohesive, nice-looking Instagram page.
She says the sheer number of Mountain West nature photographers can be daunting. It's hard to stand out and be unique while being absolutely confident that your stuff is worth seeing above all the others.
I think the hardest part is overcoming that self-doubt and the pressures that come with social media right now.
But Koch says there's a distinction between amateur photographers and professionals. One takes photos to capture the moment, while the other uses photos as a medium for art. And art generally has something to say, and Koch does have a message.
I really want to be able to show women in a more realistic way in the outdoors so that women can feel more included and empowered.
That's especially important to her, she says, as a female nature photographer in a male-dominated field. Across the country, Janet Pritchard is a photography and art professor at the University of Connecticut. She says she fell in love with photography in the Mountain West, and like Annie, she believes a true professional artist doesn't just capture a beautiful moment, they send a message.
And oftentimes those people are photographing things that are less mythic, less ideal, less beautiful, sometimes even very difficult to look at.
And of course, you can create this type of photographic art on a smartphone too. In fact, Pritchard now teaches a course on cell phone photography. That's something the famous landscape photographer Ansel Adams would have probably applauded. He predicted and welcomed the idea of digital technology in this medium. Adams died in 1984, but here he is on a BBC program the year before his death.
The thing that excites me is that within not too many years, we're going to have a entirely new medium of expression in the electronic image. And I know the potentials are there. I know it's going to be wonderful.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Coming up, a wide-ranging conversation with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon presented his budget to the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee this week, and it did not feature massive budget cuts some were predicting due to a downturn in revenue. The governor joins us to discuss his strategy along with some other topics.
Looking at the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, the CREG, and their estimates going forward, looking at our situation as it presents itself today, we were, I guess, somewhat surprised to see that we could fund the standard budget. In my view, it is something that we need to carefully consider where the cuts are going to be made. That's one reason why we set up the Power Wyoming group to help model this so that citizens of Wyoming can understand exactly what a cut here might mean. Our budget is so complicated at this point that there are federal matches, there are off general fund appropriations, their authorizations, and a number of other things. And it's a little hard for the sort of uninitiated, I guess, to really understand exactly what that means for the budget. So my view was, let's build a budget where we have the standard budget handled. If we have to make programmatic cuts, we'll make those, but we'll make those in a discerning, thoughtful way. And you did notice that I did make a substantial amount of cuts to the recommendations on capital construction. We also cut back a bit on our maintenance program. I don't feel good about that, but that gave us a little bit more headroom. It's important, I think, as we go forward, that we are able to maintain those things that we build.
Your Power Wyoming, you mentioned it. I suppose I better have you explain to the audience a little bit about what you're talking about, because you talk about it every day, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners aren't familiar with it. This is actually where you'd actually go through, and I find this so weird, Governor, you want to actually study things and find out what the impacts are. That's not how government works.
No, actually, it's all part of the transparency initiative that we have. And using the Power Wyoming modeling, it's a group of people. There's some legislators and folks from the university and others coming together to really model what happens with our budget as it goes forward. A lot of this came as an offshoot of my time at the Treasurer's office, and I have to thank former legislator Mike Madden and Senator Kale Case, for recommending that when the Treasurer gives money to new enterprises, that we actually stand up and look at what the benefit and the cost of that new enterprise is. And so taking from that, we just expanded it out. And this group released their initial study, and it's a modeling effort. It's not a prediction of the future. It's just a sense of where we're going. And the whole hope was to make things very transparent.
The way it's typically done, as you well know, is I come up with a great idea during the legislative session. I come up with an idea to cut breast cancer funding or something like that, $750,000, I believe the number was last year, without really any study. And we vote it up or we vote it down. How do you stop that from happening and let them let your system work?
Well, I'm not sure it will stop it from happening, but at least we'll be better informed, and the people of Wyoming will be better informed about what these cuts actually mean. I've talked over and over again about one of the places that we're going to see that is in the gap in funding that we have in road construction. And I've asked Director Reiner to really start to prioritize where these roads are. And it is funny, because I've heard from constituents around the state things like, well, there's nothing wrong with dirt roads, my gosh, you know, what are we going to do to fund the infrastructure we have going forward? And I think roads are a really good place to really examine the issue, because, as you know, there's a lot of effort to try to bring more electric cars to the roads as carbon-free, carbon-neutral kinds of things, a lot of Teslas and other things. And those cars don't pay the taxes that help support the Highway Trust Fund nationally. So our funding is going to be more of an issue there. So that's an example.
Visiting today with Governor Mark Gordon. Governor, the thing that I'm hearing about all summer long and all fall long is we've got to come back in and cut education. This has been something that's been growing, and we're at the point, I heard Dan Dockstader during your forum recently just say, he's already traveled to school districts to tell them they're going to get a lot less money. You have experts, you have people around you that say, hey, if you do this, this could happen, meaning lawsuit. Can we really cut much out of education?
Well, there is that view that often is put forward that the Supreme Court opined on this, and when they opined, they said there's no way you can cut it. I don't really read it quite the same way. I think the Supreme Court would have not said you need to fund education to all extents at all times. I think there has been some effort to try to figure out ways to bring more accountability to the education system. There's been discussions about reducing the number of districts, what local control actually means. The Efficiency Project talked about some opportunities there. We need to work those. We need to see if there are some places that we can make some adjustments. I don't know as though we aren't going to have to make some cuts down the road. But as I said, in this particular time with the ECA, it was something that was fairly mandated. Why go to war before you really know where your ducks are?
One of the things I thought I read that you alluded to, and I wanted to ask you about this, is I hear this from time to time. You know, we settled on a model. It's probably still not as cost-based as we would like, and maybe it's you could go in there and take the existing money you have, sort of reallocate some of it. Argument might be that there are a small school district or two that's got a little bit more than Cheyenne or Casper. Is that what you're talking about, and is that something that you would support doing?
I think we need to look really broadly across. I'm not sure it's just little districts. I mean, there, as I look at having traveled the state as much as I have, I think there are some districts that have schools that have lots of space allocation. Maybe, you know, they got a little bit more than they needed. There are some small schools. I know one really close to home, Claremont, that's very high in cost. And so I think as we look at this and start to think about how we can bring a little more standardization to the process, there may be some savings there. I don't think it's a silver bullet. I think cost of education is going up. The cost of making sure that our kids are safe, and that's an added cost we didn't really anticipate back in the day. Those things are going to be expensive. I think it's going to be a long discussion.
Governor, I was curious if you could talk a little bit about healthcare and what you've maybe learned in the last year that maybe you weren't realizing or paying that close attention to in your previous jobs. But where do you see things in the state as problematic, and do you see solutions out there anytime soon?
Healthcare is certainly one of the biggest challenges facing our nation. Just no surprise there. I come from a family with a lot of doctors and other medical related fields in it, and you know, to almost to a person, they said, you know, who would take as complex a system as we have with medicine in the United States, throw it all up in the air, build a whole new plan, the ACA, and impose it, not, you know, expect some problems to come from that. And I think we've seen that. In Wyoming specifically, as Bob, I think you have alluded to, you know, we've been struggling with this for some time. We've been trying to figure out ways that we don't bleed our care off into neighboring states. Our costs are extremely high. Our population is getting to an age where it's going to require more and more care. That care is much more expensive. All of these things are pretty daunting. Do I see a solution? Not presently, but I have hope. I really do. I think that there are some things that having a small population might allow us to do. To be pretty novel. You know, when we talk about telehealth, for example, you know, what is the way that we can deploy telehealth in a mechanism that's both cost efficient and also has a human face to it? What are the things that we can do to build out our care givers so that we have more skilled individuals willing to take that on? And then how are the ways we can support that? So with Mike Ceballos at the helm of the Department of Health, you know, we now have a way to work with our Senate to try to figure out if there are some ways forward in the existing structure. And I've said this ever since I ran for governor, I'm open to all kinds of solutions.
I want to change gears, and maybe in the final couple of minutes we have, I want to ask you about taxes. You don't like taxes. You've said that, and so we'll jump past that. You would support a tax if,
I don't think anybody likes taxes. Taxes are the way that normally you fund your government. And this morning I was saying, it's interesting to me. Last year there were two polls, one that said, I'd be willing to pay more taxes for education. And the second one said, okay, which of the taxes is it your property tax or your sales tax you'd like to pay more? And most people said, oh, no, neither one of those. We think that the energy industry should be taxing. So the reason we set up Power Wyoming, that study, really was in part to say, look, this is what's going to happen to our tax base. These are the services we want to have. How do we fund that? Now, that does not mean we go raising taxes willy-nilly. It does mean that we are so top-heavy towards the mineral industry that not only do we perhaps cause them to be less competitive, but perhaps we also put ourselves at a real vulnerability. And we've seen that 2016, 2000, actually 82,000 and others. We've seen some of these big changes that have really affected our budget. So diversifying that is something that I want to do. I don't think we can do that piecemeal. I think we need to have a robust conversation about how we're going to fund our state. What are the things that we can handle and what are the things that we cannot?
Because one of the frustrations I've had is we've never had a good conversation in our state on what services we really want to offer, and then taken a look at the price tag and then said, well, this is what we need. It's for four years, Governor, we've had this conversation about revenue, and we go, oh, what would the sales tax do to everybody? What do you have to say? And we never really came up with a plan.
No, I think that's exactly right, and I'm really committed. It may not be the best idea, but I am committed to actually moving that conversation beyond, we just escaped it another year. You know, that kicking the can down the road that we've done the last 4 years, I don't think does a great service to the people of Wyoming, and I just know that Wyoming government is better than that. I think we need to have a really good, long conversation about what the price tag on these things are, how we're going to fund it. And I don't think that we can do this by what tax loopholes are we going to reduce, what taxes are we going to increase. I think we have to look at it comprehensively.
Governor Gordon, Merry Christmas and thank you.
Well, thank you and Merry Christmas to you and everyone else.
So much of the West's water security is wrapped up in snow. When it melts, it becomes drinking and irrigation water for millions throughout the region. A high snowpack lets farmers, skiers, and water managers breathe a sigh of relief, while a low one can spell long-term trouble. Luke Runyon reports on what the upcoming winter might bring.
The start of winter doesn't smell like fresh pine trees or burning logs in the fireplace for Brian Varela. It smells like melted crayons.
And I'll just put the wax right on the waxing iron. Start dripping a little bit on there.
Varela is waxing his skis. They're propped up on a wooden bench in his Fort Collins, Colorado garage. His work area is bordered by a string of multicolored Christmas lights.
I'm not really thinking about anything except skis and snow and getting outside with my friends, and that's it.
Nice. It's kind of a zen centering moment.
It is, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
The thinking goes, if you wax it, the snow will come. And Varela's hoping for a repeat of last winter, which was one of the most abundant for the Southern Rockies in the last decade.
Now, I'll admit this year, I didn't put the stuff away. I left most of my tools out. We actually skied into July 4th.
But at the start of each ski season, no one really knows how it'll all shake out.
I used to worry about it. I used to wonder, is it going to be a great snow year? Is it going to be a good snow year? Am I wasting my money going up in the mountains to play? anymore, I don't worry about it.
Varela says people in the recreational community have a selective memory when it comes to snow. They tend to only remember the good times and forget the years cut short by a lack of snow in the mountains. It's the opposite for those in charge of using that melted snow to keep faucets flowing in Arizona.
It's visceral, right?
Catherine Sorensen is in charge of Phoenix's water utility. The city gets more than 30% of its water from the Colorado River, which gets its start high up in snowy mountains.
Because so much of what we do depends on, you know, the availability of water and hydrology that, yeah, it's almost like a gut emotional reaction to both good years and bad years.
Unlike Brian Varela, Sorensen can rattle off the bad snow years with ease. 2002, 2012, 2013, and the most recent, the record-setting hot and dry winter of 2018.
We're always, you know, hoping for good snowpack, and when it's absent, sure, we get nervous. But again, that's why we plan methodically for worst-case scenarios so that we are prepared come what may on the Colorado River watershed.
Any one year does not set the whole system into either, you know, crisis or into recovery.
Jeff Lucas is a water researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder. Whatever happens this winter, high snow, low snow, or somewhere in between, he says it won't cause the Colorado River's biggest reservoirs to rise or fall in any dramatic way. That takes back-to-back years of extreme highs or lows.
There's no good that comes from a low runoff year like 2018. But it's not the end of the world, especially if you're lucky enough to have that followed with a high runoff year like we had in 2019.
And if 2020 brings another high snowpack year, that doesn't mean the Colorado River is out of crisis mode. It just means we've kicked the can down the road because over the long term, Lucas says climate change is diminishing snowpack across the West.
And increasingly, we're seeing unprecedented conditions relative to the last 100 or 120 years of record. Like there's an erosion of the value of the past as a guide to the future.
Back in Brian Varela's garage, the newly waxed skis are fully cured. He picks up a plastic tool to scrape off the excess.
And there you have a home-tuned ski. It looks pretty good.
Can you make a prediction of whether it's going to be a good year or a bad year for snow, or is it still too early to say?
My prediction is this is going to be a fantastic year. We're off to a good start, man. We're just going to keep that momentum going, get as many people as we can excited about this.
Yeah.
Early winter optimism. I'm Luke Runyon in Fort Collins, Colorado.
This story is part of ongoing Colorado River coverage in partnership with KUNC in Colorado, supported by a Walton Family Foundation grant.
We will wrap up the program with the author of Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese and hear about an award given to a Cheyenne principal. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Lakota author, poet, and Indian Country Today columnist Tiffany Midge has a new book. Many of her humorous essays have been compiled in Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese. In this new book, she talks about Native representation in movies, pussy hats, and why humor is important in Indian Country. Taylor Stagner has more.
In her new book, Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese, Tiffany Midge combines popular culture with indigenous humor. Her collection of essays repackages many stories like 50 Shades of Grey, The King and I, and Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. I asked the Standing Rock Lakota author why it's important to indigenize popular culture.
Well, I think for the most part it's because those cultural touchstones are also a part of Native life. I mean, you know, I'm Native, but I'm also an American, and I have to use the things that are within my environment. And you know, because I'm a popular, you know, pop culture junkie, those are things that are really prevalent within my environment. So it just sort of, you have to just mash the two. In my own mind, I have to mash the two. The poet Denise Duhamel, who's one of my favorite poets, she said that popular culture was her religion. And that's always really stuck with me.
Midge is a poet, and after the 2016 presidential election, she started sending in op-eds to Indian Country Today. They liked her, and her long career as a poet translated well into her essay writing.
My first book came out in like 1996, and then my second book of poems came out in 20 years later, in 2016. So there was like quite a departure for me insofar as publishing and writing. And then the second book, 20 years later, there's a lot of really funny things in there. So, but they're just, I think they're just a little more subtle, right? And then after the presidential elections, I started to send in op-eds, columns for Indian Country Today. And I just started regularly sending them in, and the editor just, you know, continually kept taking them. And so I was writing those for like a year and a half. And that's kind of what gave me the idea to write a book of humor essays, these bizarre, strange, twisted commentary on things that were happening in Indian Country.
Her new book has elements of dark humor that combines sobering reality with levity. Midge finds that most cultures have elements of dark humor, and Native people are no different.
Well, I feel like the two have been, you know, married for millennia. I mean, I think first comedy was just based on something that was really dark. We're trying to make light of something that might have been really dark, you know. I mean, it's just that coping and survival mechanism that kicks in. And, you know, it's true across the board, not just with, you know, Native people or Native humor. It's just true across comedy in general. With reservation humor, you know, it's considered to be, you know, pretty rugged. Those chapter headings that are all, you know, basically just jokes. And all of the jokes pertain to the subject matter within that chapter. And one of the ways that I determined to sort of thread everything together into some sort of cohesiveness, because the beginning of the book is very different. That as you get farther towards the end of the book, things like shift quite a lot insofar as like, you know, tone and just style, right? It goes from memoir to these like little sound bites, basically, and then this political humor. And being able to write these little jokes that look like little poems, in a sense, is a way to sort of sew it all together. That was just sort of a cohesive anchor for me.
Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese is now available. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Educators put in a lot of time with little recognition, but sometimes a light shines on their work. Recently in Cheyenne, a well-thought-of principal was awarded a major prize. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel explains.
Johnson Junior High School in Cheyenne has never had an all-school assembly. Recently, it had its first. Over 800 7th and 8th grade students came to a gathering in the school gym. Students and teachers expected an appearance from Wyoming Superintendent of Public Instruction Jillian Balow. Brian Cox, the school's principal, organized the whole thing. He expected her to recognize the school's initiatives to ensure that all students had access to breakfast. And at first, she did.
Morning, Firebirds. It is not very often on a Monday morning that I don't have to do a couple of things to pep you up, but I think I know why everyone is already pepped up and spirited. Students, would you stand up if you ate breakfast this morning?
But little did Cox know that the multiple VIPs were there to honor him with the Milk and Education Award. Cox was obviously surprised to hear his name called as the next Milk and Educator. The award recognizes outstanding educators across the country. And in addition to being recognized, he receives a $25,000 award. Cox will also have the opportunity to take part in several professional development programs. And the cash award can be used for anything he wants.
One of the things I probably will do is we started a scholarship fund, my wife and I did, here for students of Johnson Junior High School, and we'll probably put a little bit of that money into that scholarship fund to continue helping our kids.
Cox says he spends a lot of time focused on his students, and it starts very early in the day.
When you have the opportunity to get up a half hour early and work that much harder for your kids, do it. I get up every morning at 2:30, and that's something that I do just specifically to make sure I can be here for kids when kids are here.
The award was handed out by Greg Gallagher of the Milken Family Foundation, and he says that preparation shows Cox's dedication to his students.
He's a great leader, obviously, as a principal, but also he's empowering his students to become leaders as well. He doesn't just lead by his words, he leads by his actions. He's also a hometown hero. He helps out in the community, and he's teaching the students about the importance of civics because they're also helping out in the community.
The Milken Educator Award has been called the Oscars of Teaching. Recipients are selected using a confidential selection process. They don't apply, and they're not nominated. And every award is given as a surprise.
I was preparing this one for quite a while because since we have Mr. Cox as the principal, he was actually planning his own surprise. So when I showed up, and I'm talking with him, I had to kind of keep who I was a secret, which is not easy for me.
Of the up to 40 educators being honored this year, Cox is the only winner from Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you want to hear the whole show or an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You'll never miss a show if you get our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Anna Rader for making that all happen.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.